Welcome to today's episode of the Gone Fishin' Nuclear Report. This podcast is your one-stop source for all the latest news in the Department of Energy's Environmental Management Program across the nation. Now with today's report, here is your host, Michael Butler.
Thank you, Jennifer, and hello, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of the Gone Fishin' Nuclear Report. Today is Monday, July 25th, 2022. We're covering all the news from the Department of Energy's Environmental Management Program across the country. In today's Spotlight interview, we'll visit the Department of Energy's Fernald site in Ohio for the third installment of our series on wildlife at EM sites. Cleanup at Fernald, which once produced uranium metal for nuclear weapons production, is complete, and the site has been turned over to DOE's Legacy Management Group for long-term stewardship. Fernald is unique in that it offers regular tours for the public, giving them a chance to see up close the variety of wildlife that inhabits the site. Today, we'll be talking with Angela Martzi, an interpretive specialist dealing with history and wildlife at Fernald.
Well, Fernald's case is very unique. In the case of Fernald Preserve, the commitment and importance of protecting wildlife is written into our end-use decision. The community decided they wanted the Fernald Preserve site to stay an undeveloped park with an emphasis on wildlife. And as I mentioned previously, the landscape is managed rather than the wildlife. So the habitats are maintained in order to encourage that wildlife. I personally like to think of it as the Field of Dreams strategy. If you build it, they will come. And that works very well in the case of wildlife. With Fernald Preserve, we provide quality wildlife habitat, and the wildlife is naturally attracted to it. It's done very well.
You'll hear more from Angela later in the podcast. And be sure to join us next week for our final installment when we visit the Idaho National Laboratory site to talk about wildlife in that remote setting.
We are pleased to report that the Gone Fishin' Nuclear Report is now ranked in Apple's top 200 podcasts in the business news category. This category includes approximately 2,000 podcasts. The leading podcasts in this category include The Wall Street Journal Money Report, CNBC's Squawk on the Street, Bloomberg Law, and Yahoo Financial Daily. Thanks to you, our listeners, for making us one of the most popular podcasts in Apple's business news category. We'll continue to bring you the news and features on important topics from the Department of Energy's Environmental Management Program.
Now here with today's top story is Michael Butler.
Senate Energy and Natural Resources Chair Joe Manchin wants to form a new independent agency that would operate as a permanent home for the nation's nuclear waste. The West Virginia Democrats' Nuclear Waste Administration Act would create an agency apart from the Department of Energy and would be charged with finding and operating a permanent nuclear waste repository, in all likelihood outside of Yucca Mountain. Manchin's draft bill, which is expected to get a hearing Thursday in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, would compel the newly formed Nuclear Waste Agency to choose a repository on a consent-based format. Such a format would effectively kill the Yucca Mountain proposal, as both parties in Nevada are opposed to the potential repository. The consent-based approach was part of a recommendation made by an Obama-era commission that studied how to best deal with existing and future nuclear waste. Many of the legislation's provisions appear to be inspired by the commission's findings. Savannah River site officials recently donated a heavy rescue truck worth over $1 million to the city of Aiken, South Carolina. The truck is designed to transport highly specialized equipment and specially trained personnel to locations where a technical rescue is required. Technical rescues can include vehicle extrication and those of a more infrequent nature involving confined space, trenches, structural collapse, water, and wilderness search and rescue. These trucks often carry an assortment of supplies and equipment, including electrical generators, the jaws of life, acetylene torches, winches, cranes, jacks, ropes and pulleys, and wooden support beams.
And now it's time for People in the News.
Rick McLeod, president and CEO of the Savannah Riverside Community Reuse Organization, has announced his plans to retire at the end of the year. He has held the post since 2008. In a letter to his board of directors, McLeod called his time with the CRO a truly enjoyable experience and cited the opportunities he has had for personal and professional development. McLeod is a leading spokesperson for CROs around the country, speaking regularly at national conferences and testifying before congressional committees. There is no word on a replacement. In other people news, Rick Morin, senior program manager for Northwind Solutions at Hanford, was on hand to receive an award from the Tri-City Regional Chamber of Commerce recently. Northwind is a subcontractor of Hanford Mission Integration Solutions, which provides infrastructure and site services in support of environmental cleanup at Hanford. Northwind has been on site as a contractor for more than 20 years. And finally, EM Senior Advisor Ike White appeared before the House Space Science and Technology Committee to discuss current research and development programs within the EM office. At the hearing, White responded to a question from Representative Suzanne Bonamici of Oregon about how long cleanup would continue at the Hanford site in Washington State.
So in your written testimony, you mentioned Hanford, and you talk about the storage and disposal of spent nuclear fuel as a top cleanup priority for the Office of EM. You also mentioned expediting the cleanup. So the last report that I saw, and hopefully you can update me on this, was intended to be about a 30-year project, but now they're projecting about 75 years. Can you give us an update on how long you expect the Hanford cleanup to take?
How long it takes depends in part on exactly what we do to do the cleanup, and that's something that we're still working through. But I would say on the order of six decades would be a good guess. I mean, but again, there's a lot of uncertainty associated with that number.
How often do you update that number based on the technologies that are being developed?
We update the number based on a number of different factors, right? It depends on how you characterize the number. If you evaluate it as part of an environmental liability, those numbers get updated on an annual basis. When we redo life cycle cost analysis work, those get updated from time to time. We most recently had the Corps of Engineers, for example, do an independent life cycle cost analysis for that work and update their expectations. When we do a system plan, every couple of years working with our regulator, we redo the system plan for the waste there based on what our current expectations are for regulatory requirements, and we'll update the number based on what that is. We're currently involved at the moment, for example, in holistic negotiations with the state of Washington Department of Ecology on what the cleanup plan might look like, and whatever comes out of that set of discussions with the state of Washington would also drive another look at what we expect that time frame to be. So I know that's not a simple or straightforward answer, but there's a lot of different ways that we do that depending on what the use of the number is going to be.
We'll have more on Ike White's congressional appearance in next week's podcast.
You're up to date on the latest DOE environmental management news. Now it's time for this week's Spotlight interview featuring a special guest. Here again is Michael Butler.
Now it's time for this week's Spotlight interview. We're talking with Angela Marzi, an interpretive specialist at the Fernald Preserve, a former environmental management site in Ohio. This interview is the third in a four-part series on wildlife at Department of Energy sites. What kind of species exist? How are they protected? And do they ever interfere with cleanup operations? You can review these episodes at our website at gonefishingpodcast.com. Now here's our interview with Angela Marzi. Well, we have a lot to talk about with what's going on at the Fernald site with the wildlife and the nature preserve. Let's start in a general way by just reminding our listeners about the Fernald site and what the purpose of the site was when it was operating. I know it shut down in 1989 and was operated more than 35 years, but what was the general purpose and function of the site when it was operating?
Well, its focus was uranium metals processing and fabrication during the Cold War years. So from 1951, like you said, to 1989, it was engaged in that work. And its sole purpose was to fabricate high purity uranium metal feed rods that were mostly shipped out to the Hanford, Washington site and a few others. And they were designed to be fed into nuclear reactors to undergo fission. So Fernald wasn't the first step in the weapons complex chain, but it was one of the early phases.
Okay. And these nuclear production sites were located all over the country. Each of them did a specialized task that ended up supporting the nuclear weapons program. And Fernald was one of those very critical sites.
Yes, indeed.
Let's start by talking about your public tours. I think Fernald, from what I can tell, is very unique. You've already gone through the environmental cleanup process. The site has been transferred to DOE's Legacy Management Group, and you're in a kind of a supervisory management role for the site now. Talk about the tours and what you do in terms of keeping the history of the site alive and coordinating with the members of the public, particularly when it comes to nature and wildlife at the site.
Well, as I mentioned before, I do lead history as well as nature programs on the site, and we provide a little bit of everything. Once a month, we publish a flyer that lists our public program schedule, and we almost always have something going on every Saturday and Sunday on the site year-round. And these programs can include a wide variety of topics, including astronomy, pollinators, fireflies, birds and bird watching, of course. We have a lot of birds on the site and a lot of bird watchers. We also offer night hikes and go to look and listen for owls and flying squirrels, as well as topics on beavers, white-tailed deer, you name it. Any animal that we've got on site, we generally do a program about it.
Well, let's go down the list a little bit on the kind of wildlife that exists on the Fernald site. Can you describe the variety that you have there?
We have a wide variety of wildlife on the site. As of this year, we've logged over 254 species of birds observed on site, both year-round resident birds as well as migratory. And those include everything from the usual suspects of warblers and summer songbirds that come through, scarlet tanagers, blue grosbeaks, palm warblers. We noticed a lot of those this year. We also have migratory raptors that come through, short-eared owls, long-eared owls, saw-whets, and northern harriers in the wintertime. Bald eagles have been spotted on site, ospreys. As far as the mammals go, the sky's the limit. White-tailed deer, of course, like in a lot of sites, a lot of beaver, mink, several species of weasel, lots of rodent species, and newer resident forests are bobcats have been spotted on site. Wide variety of reptiles and amphibians and insect and pollinators as well.
Well, that's quite a variety. What do you consider to be your most unusual species of wildlife? I know at Savannah River, for example, they've got alligators down there on site, and Hanford has elk. Do you have anything that you would consider unusual or maybe the most common things that that you see there?
Well, I would say the species that most of our visitors are very fascinated about, and understandably so, are bobcats. They're a more recent return mammal species to Ohio. And for the past 7 or 8 years, I believe, we've placed wildlife cameras at different locations on the site. And we've noticed that there's been at least one female bobcat that's raised a litter of kittens on site every year. So when we get new videos of bobcats and the bobcat families, our visitors are very excited to see those.
Do you have any endangered species?
Nothing endangered endemic to the site. We do have a species of mammal that is more on the rare side, but that we're very excited about having on site. And it's a little guy called a least weasel. They're the smallest carnivorous mammal, not just in North America, but in the world. And from nose to the tip of the tail, they're only about 7 inches long. And they prefer grassland and marshy grassland habitats. And that is typical of the habitat at Fernald. So we're very excited to have those observed on the site.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's get back to the tours for a minute. Tell us how those tours work. I assume you have school groups and others. What kind of people come through on tours, and how are those arranged? Who can go on the tour? How often are they held? And just to tell us about the mechanics of the tours.
Well, the public programs are open to anyone, of course. And again, we publish our monthly flyer that people can take a look at what we're offering that particular month. Due to current COVID restrictions, we are limited on group sizes that we're able to serve. And people are able to email us at fernald@lm.doe.gov for more information on a program or to register. Or they can visit our website, and that's www.energy.gov/LM/Fernald Preserve Ohio site. I know that's a mouthful.
Well, it is. I'll tell you, though, we'll put that on our Gone Fish and Nuclear Report podcast website. And so listeners who want to take advantage of the tours or want to know more about it, we'll have information on the website about that contact information. So the tours take place on buses. You take people out on buses?
Pretty much everything that we do is on foot. We hike to different areas of the preserve, both on public access trail and in some areas that are staff-only access to get a better look at what's out there. We do offer driving tours. If anyone is interested, we are able to take them around the on-site disposal facility, as well as some of the less accessible by foot areas as well. And we're more than happy to do that.
Are the tours year round, or are they limited to certain times of the year, or do you take people all year?
We take people all year. We do have some subjects that are more seasonal in nature. The flying squirrel programs, for example, we do those in the wintertime when our observation area to go out and look for them, they're a lot more active. We do have more waterfowl programs in the fall when the seasonal migration is happening, as well as in the early spring. And of course, the summer songbirds that come and visit us, we do some more early morning hikes at that time. But we welcome people all year round, and the site is open dawn to dusk all year.
Now, my understanding is these tours are pretty popular. You get a good response, a lot of people wanting to go. Is that right?
We have gotten a very good response. And although we do, like I said, offer certain seasonal program subjects yearly, we try to come up with new ideas all the time. And a lot of those are taken from what we observe as staff. We are out and about on the site. And if we see something interesting, then we can go ahead and start a new program for people.
Now, this is a former nuclear production site. Do people have to have any kind of special identification, or are there any requirements, the security requirements related to the tours?
There aren't. We do offer public access just on the hiking trails. When we take a group in an off public access area, the staff does have identification on so that other staff know that we're authorized to be in that area, but there are no security requirements for people to attend.
Do you take any special measures to protect wildlife on the site? I know at some of the other sites that are still under EM control, where cleanup is going on. There's a couple of things. One is there is some protection programs, but the other is concerns about wildlife even interfering or threatening to interfere with the cleanup process. Do you have any of those kind of concerns, and what about protection of the wildlife?
Well, one thing I like the take that Fernald has with wildlife management, we don't specifically manage for the wildlife species, but we focus on managing the site's habitats. And the habitat is very diverse. We've got over 400 acres of forest, nearly 400 acres of restored Ohio prairie grasslands, and 140 acres of wetland and open water habitat. And our management team is focused on taking care of that, such as dealing with an invasive species, honeysuckle and teasel and other types of plants. And we do controlled burns to maintain the restored prairie grassland habitat as it is.
Are there any, we've talked about a lot here in the last few minutes, but are there any additional points that you'd like to address relative to the Fernald Preserve and your preservation activities there?
Well, like many facilities, not just Legacy Management, not just Fernald Preserve, during COVID, our mission to educate visitors about the wildlife and the history of the site did have to change a bit. And we went virtual. We wound up going virtual for a lot of program offerings. We did virtual programming for public and private groups as usual. But in addition, our interpretive staff created a lot of social media posts and short video presentations, our Nature Aha Moments series, to keep visitors up to date about what was happening with the wildlife on site as well. And those proved to be very popular. We were very excited about the reception for them. Most of those can be viewed on the Department of Energy's Office of Legacy Management Facebook page. They're posted up there for everyone, and every time we have a new one come out, it gets posted on that. And some of our programs that we offered virtually during COVID have carried over into our in-person programming again. One of those was a nature book club that I started called Wild Reads, and it's proven to be very popular. But like everyone else, we're super happy to be continuing our educational work and serving the community face-to-face again. We've missed everyone.
Very good. Angela, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. This has been very interesting and informative, and really appreciate you being with us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure to be a part of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the Gone Fishin' Nuclear Report podcast. Join us next week for more news about DOE's environmental management program across the nation. To comment on this episode, hear past episodes, or suggest a future interview guest, visit us at gonefishinpodcast.com. You'll also find links to topics of interest covered in this podcast. Visit gonefishinpodcast.com.